MSSPs and other security service providers comprise the backbone of the cybersecurity industry. They are the organizations on the front line that keep the world running in the face of ever more sophisticated adversaries. In this special series, we're going to be exploring a variety of topics with seasoned experts around the ways they have learned to improve the effectiveness of their organizations. Our guest today is Andrew Cook, CTO of Recon InfoSec, and we're going to be talking about scaling an MSSP, operational hurdles, and strategies for growth. But first, a word from the sponsor of this show, Lima Charlie.
My name is Maxime Lamadbrassard, and I'm the founder of Lima Charlie, the company behind the SecOps Cloud platform. Cybersecurity tools today need to evolve from one-size-fits-all silos into a modern tool set designed to adapt to your specific needs. The SecOps Cloud platform works by providing you with ungated access to the underlying security tools and infrastructure you need. Everything is on demand with no minimums, no contracts. It's an approach to cybersecurity that's very similar to that taken by AWS with respect to IT. We offer a full-featured free tier with no credit card required. Get on the platform today and deploy an EDR, start ingesting logs, build a product, or start an MSSP. We're making security flexible so you can build what's possible. You can learn more or get started for free at limacharlie.io.
My guest today is Andrew Cook, the Chief Technology Officer at Recon InfoSec, where he leads the technical vision, strategy, and execution of the company's managed security operations. With over a decade of experience in threat hunting, digital forensics, and network defense, Andrew has built a career at the forefront of cybersecurity. Before joining Recon InfoSec, he held key leadership roles at Praetorian, Delta Risk, and the U.S. Air Force, where he contributed to national-level cyber defense initiatives. He has a strong background in incident response, capability development, and technical leadership. Andrew is also a frequent speaker and author in the cybersecurity community. It's a real honor to have you here today, Andrew. Thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, Chris.
Before we get into it, you know, I'm always interested to hear people's stories about how they got interested in technology and how that turned into a career in cybersecurity. Can you maybe, you know, give us the high-level background?
Yeah, so I think I credit my mom for getting me into computers in the first place, right? She was doing her like associate's degree and she was in IT. So she was the one who brought the computers in the house, but, you know, and then grew up on sort of tech TV and you know, the heyday of that kind of thing. But my start in cybersecurity really started from the Air Force. So I went through RDC in college. And the thing that attracted me to the Air Force in particular was at that time, this was 2007 or so, they had just added cybersecurity into their mission. So the Air Force was the first to sort of recognize cyber as a warfighting domain, whatever that meant. So I said, hey, if I'm going to try any of these out, I'm going to try the computer nerds out in the Air Force and then never look back. So yeah, I got to do a lot of cool things in there. And a lot of the philosophies and techniques and sort of underpinnings come from a lot of those Air Force experiences and programs through the Air Force Research Labs and some big thinking around what the future of cybersecurity sort of look like. And now we're 15 years later, whatever it is now, we're sort of in that and living it, trying to make it happen.
Yeah, I've met a lot of really talented practitioners in cyber, Eric Capuano, Paul Imey, and the list goes on, who came out of the Air Force. So it sounds like they have a really great program for developing talent.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And a lot of those folks go out having seen what we were doing in the Air Force. There's a reason they wind up where they're doing next. They're at these next level solutions, or they're at sort of these consult. They're trying to take that knowledge out and say, hey, we can do this in the private sector, right? So you see some cool companies and startups coming out of the Air Force, and then some really pivotal people in the community in the right spots, and they all have very similar backgrounds. So it's fun to see where we all sort of landed and what we're working on.
Yeah. And so you've been at Recon InfoSec for a little bit of time now and sort of moved up the ranks and become the CTO. What was your role when you first joined and how did that evolve?
Yeah, so I joined, man, I don't know my background without looking at LinkedIn, but I think it was something like 4 years ago now, right? So yeah, Eric Capuano, you know, great guy. He was CTO at the time, co-founder of Recon. And, you know, we'd been working for the Air National Guard together on a lot of different things. And I was getting weak, you know, that's the 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year kind of deal, right? At least that's what they tell you. So every weekend would be sort of hey, I'm starting this thing called Recon. And then over a couple of years of, hey, this thing's getting bigger. Hey, we're getting a little bit more serious. Hey, I quit my day job. you know, he was always up to something interesting. And so me coming in, I came in as the director of security operations. And it was when Recon was really pivoting to focus on building out that, I guess what we're calling here an MSSP, but that managed security offering, you know, to really lean into. They had the good start of a 24/7, you know, monitoring, detection, response sort of team, and they wanted me to come in and bring it to the next level. So yeah, took that and had a lot of fun. Basically got, that was my chance to really be holding on to the steering wheel and implementing the vision that I had sort of described to a lot of people of how things should be done. And yeah, rode that all the way to where we are today, finding seven bad guys every day, running a world-class SOC and having fun doing it.
Awesome. And you've worked in both sort of the enterprise SOC, where you're sort of protecting the single organization, and now spent this time at Recon, where you guys are the security service provider for multiple organizations. What are the major differences there? Is there a difference in philosophy, or is it more operational?
Yeah. So like when I talk to people at a single SOC, there's some advantages and there's some disadvantages. One disadvantage is, or let's start with the advantages of working sort of more in that MSSP model, or is the variety of environments and also the variety of threats, which always means that something is happening, right? Whereas counterpoint, a lot of organizations, a lot of people are analysts that are just working in a single sort of in-house SOC. The most they might get is maybe this year we'll get a pen test. Very rarely is there a constant, you know, every day new challenge, a new threat. And sometimes you can sit there for a long time without a new picture of a bad guy. But sitting in-house, that variety also means a variety of threats and a variety of challenges. The other things is, you know, maybe it's just an artifact of doing this as a service, but when you're working at an MSSP, security is a core business imperative. Like it's a core competency, meaning that, you know, it's not a cost sink necessarily. So you get sort of a different type of attention, right? When you need to be building a SOC that is competitive with the market and that customers are happy with and has good retention. Whereas, you know, there's the potential, if you're sitting in-house, that you're sort of just fighting for budget and it's sort of more thought of as a cost sink. So yeah, there's some incentives there to be doing sort of cybersecurity as a business.
So in the MSSP model, it's more you have to prove your security competency every day, whereas in the enterprise, you're kind of justifying your existence.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of what you're doing is more tuned toward politicking and justifying your existence and showing your worth and sort of proving that you're, you know, trying to make that there. Whereas with delivering it as a service, exactly, you're sort of in a constant competition where excellence is rewarded and recognized and creates some good pressure to keep improving and keep up with everybody else, right? So it's always a fun challenge.
Very cool. And so we've known each other, I think, probably almost the whole time you've been at Recon. And in that time, you guys have grown significantly. And I know we helped you solve some of the scaling problems that you were facing. Can you kind of talk about, as you grew, what those scaling issues look like and maybe how you were first addressing them and what eventually kind of solved them for you?
Yeah. So when I first joined, again, we had the seed of what looked like the start of what could be a really high performing, right, well scaling SOC. And so that was my challenge, is to take that. The first challenge of bringing it to the next level was really leaning heavy into introducing an automation layer, right? Where I never want our analysts to be sort of just on the other end of a ticket taking machine, right? So a lot of SOCs are structured as more of like a help desk model, right? So a lot of SOCs evolved from, you know, help desk call center type models,
the help desk.
Right? Because it came out of IT. Then you stuck the Star Trek looking SOC wall up there and tried to figure out how to impress people with what was on your data wall, and you called that a SOC, but you really had a bunch of kind of ticket taking thinking and machinery. So introducing that automation layer, empowering all the analysts to be building and controlling our own detections, to be building our own workflows, to be building our own playbooks, not just be a victim of just this onslaught of, you know, garbage alerts. And so that was step one, right? To sort of add sanity to the process of the SecOps processes. On the engineering side, is right around when we started talking to Lean Maturely. So the cybersecurity ultimately becomes a big data problem, right? So we've introduced a lot of telemetry, events, log sources, EDR, streaming telemetry. All of that is sort of the hidden cost that people underestimate when they're trying to get involved or in developing a more mature SOC, right? It's one thing to take alerts and throw them into a alert system. It's another thing to be managing terabytes, gigabytes, whatever you're working of logs, and keep all of that flowing, and then keep detections running on time and keep the latency down and keep the, you know, the shards balanced and all the other things you got to do on the data engineering side that you might not appreciate. So when we approached Lima Charlie, we were getting to that stage where the risk of introducing, you know, more data was leading, could be starting to lead to issues on that side. You know, detections that should have fired weren't firing, or maybe firing minutes, half hours later than they should. The costs were only going up, and our ability to control what telemetry was going into the system and what how it was being stored was of limited options, right? And we were doing a lot of CPR on the data engineering side just to keep the smoke inside the machine, right? So
yeah, you mentioned sharding, which is like you're down there in the weeds trying to figure out how stuff is. Yeah.
So we really wanted to focus on our core competencies, right? So which is that security operations piece, the threat hunting, the incident response, the detection engineering, the tuning, the security operations workflows, playbook development, and serving our customers. Nobody wants to worry about the plumbing. They just want to trust that it's working. So yeah, so moving to Lima Charlie was a way to make sure that we could continue to have really complex rules and detections and not worry about how those are going to scale up there in the cloud and continue moving at wire speed, how we're going to keep moving all the logs from all the different customers into all the right places with all the right API keys, right? And keep it all multi-tenant. And Lima Charlie was really, that was the original approach for getting in and talking to you guys. Yeah.
Was there anything you tried along the way that was disastrous? You guys had originally built most of your tech stack using open source products, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So we really appreciate what you can do with open source projects. And even this year, one of our commitments is to be contributing more into the open source community and sort of refresh some of those efforts. The problem in trying to develop an entire solution off of an open source solution is, again, that hidden cost of maintaining it, developing it. You know, it doesn't come with support. Yeah. And you know, not all of them are meant to scale to the enterprise side. So, you know, we were using solutions that might cap out at a few thousands of endpoints before they really lost their ability to scale. There was no more horizontal or vertical scaling for that solution, right?
Yeah, that was it.
And yeah, so, you know, things like, I think Elasticsearch is open source, but some of those original solutions, we're starting to show the edges, right? Of what you could do without a lot of, again, I've worked, I can't name drop where these are, but they put the engineering efforts into turning some of those open source projects into really elaborate, federated, you know, scalable solutions that work across hundreds of thousands of endpoints, when really, if you just get it from GitHub, it's going to top out at 10,000. That's still a lot of work, right? And is that what we wanted to be doing? Or did we want to be doing the SecOps and we wanted to be doing the security operations?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of people in information security who learned a lot more about software engineering than they ever intended to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. On this side of your team and operationally, were there key hires or changes to the team structure that you guys took to improve the efficiency? Was there anything improved on the way you guys run that side of the house?
So I'll start with a philosophy and then I'll probably back into the question. Philosophically, the way that we run our SOC and really the whole company is that everyone's a builder, right? So that could mean you do development and can you find a problem and, you know, craft up some code and push it somewhere. But really what we mean is it's the exact opposite of that ticket-taking machine. Nobody's here just to work alerts, get through the, be a cog and, you know, get down to the queue. We're all building this machine together. And so empowering everybody with the tools, right? The ability to write their own detections, to tune their own detections, to modify the playbooks together, to write the workflows and instructions and the processes. That's goal number one. Okay, cool. So now you've got a lot of people building a lot of things and you start growing and people start specializing a little bit more. And so the need for a dedicated engineering resource. You know, you can't wear that. Everybody's wearing that hat, but now you're wearing that hat a little bit more. So you start hiring some of those key positions to take over some of those key roles around the engineering, the, you know, you start structuring the SOC, not necessarily in tiers, because I don't want that, but you got to start thinking about who's mentoring and leading who and introducing some of those, yeah, some of those new folks to the experienced folks. So it's, I don't think there's really been any key hires. I think they're all important. It's more about separating out the things that need to scale and giving them an owner, right? Whilst continuing to let everybody have a lot of the creativity that they had it when, you know, maybe it didn't quite have that same owner.
Do you guys have a process for, like, I have an idea for automating the collection of some type of telemetry and it's using a new technology that we've never had in this MSSP before. How does that go from my bright idea to proof of concept to production? Do you guys have a process for vetting?
So one of the, again, one of those underpinning philosophies that drive us is threat hunting. So what do I mean by that? I mean that we have this sort of radically threat-centric approach toward of thinking about what's on the priority list, what's important, what we're doing, what we need. Is it going to help us find bad guys? Is it going to help us find the threat? So it starts with most of our higher priority requirements come from, is it going to help us be in a new environment where the threats are, right? Is that new log source or telemetry or capability necessary, going to increase our chances of finding bad guys, right? So that's where those priorities come from. A lot of the times what winds up happening is we'll direct a threat hunt towards some hypothesis, right? Some threat that we think maybe is new or novel or that we wouldn't have found yesterday that we should be able to find tomorrow. Those start kind of manual, right? Hey, we're going to do it the hard way. We're going to learn a lot of things. We're going to do it, with not much more than our own brains and the couple tools that might be out there already. We're going to try to leverage those things. But where there's gaps, hey, this would have been easier if we had it automated or this script already existed or we had a dashboard for this thing. It starts marching toward that sort of automation and development pipeline until it becomes a full capability, right? So anyway, that's sort of how those ideas come from the analysts and the operators. And then start moving up in the maturity chain until they're owned by more of the developers, right? So you got to go through a kind of a rapid innovation process and then give them the tools that they need.
So from your perspective, how does an MSSP balance that growth with tool sprawl? You mentioned a bunch of tools there, and I know one of the challenges is, oh, we'll just put this here and we'll put this here. And next thing you know, you've got 27 contracts you have to negotiate every year.
Yeah. So a lot of that comes from people that don't know how to use the tools that they already have, I think, to be honest, and they think that another tool will save them. So our first question for all of those requirements is really dig deep and say, can we do this with what we already have? Are we using our existing capabilities to the max? You know, are you asking the right question? Are you using the right tool to answer that question? Is it really not possible? And, you know, use some critical thinking about how you might be able to use what we already have. Yeah. And then again, that gain loss or that ROI decision, will that new investment lead to finding stopping threats? Like, what are the odds? That's probably the biggest vote for us is that, again, that threat-centric thinking. Is it actually going to have lead to better security outcomes, right?
Very early in the conversation, you were talking about the difference between enterprises and MSSPs. So being at a SOC in an enterprise versus an MSSP with multiple clients and all the different environments and technologies you have to deal with. How do you ensure that the security standards remain consistent in these environments with multiple clients, with multiple tech stacks?
Yep. So that's on my pros and cons list in my head. One of the challenges for being a service provider is that requirement for multi-tenancy and then, you know, any other sort of security requirements you sort of inherit from your customers can limit the options and the technologies that you might be able to use or start playing with, right? So, you know, we've looked at solutions that if I was just one running the in-house SOC I'd be picking up tomorrow, right, and plugging it in and using it. But when you're a service provider, you've got to really lean into the multi-tenancy features, the data segmentation kind of features, the data residency features in some cases. And it also means that you've got to worry about the configuration control in a multi-tenant environment, right? So what is onboarding? What does it look like to stage this solution? What does it mean to onboard this solution? What does it mean to configure and then continue to configure and maintain this solution? It's one thing, you know, a lot of products, maybe they have a really rough onboarding experience, but once they're set up, you're having a great time with it. Okay, is that a realistic solution when you've got to do onboardings, you know, all the time? Whereas if it's not just a one and done, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking of onboarding, how's your approach to client management evolved as you've grown? I know that often takes a lot of time and it's one of the most important aspects of the business. So how do you handle those personal relationships on top of the technical challenges?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the cornerstone for us is we really want to know our customers. So we're always going to want to be having like those monthly calls and those check-ins. We always invite our customers to like our Thursday defensive webinar so they can see what we're up to and you know, learn about what we're talking about on that webinar. What's become more important is so that we can focus on those human relationships, making sure that our ability for customers to do some like self-service management, some leverage through our security portal, some of our communications, some of our, you know, some of that sort of at scale things to sort of run the service at scale, vulnerability notifications, things like that, stuff that just needs to be part of the machine and that you can take off of our plate or, you know, let a customer do themselves without going through extra hoops. So that when we are talking to customers, it's about the real meaningful things, not about like, hey, are we going to fix this adapter or onboard a new log source, that kind of thing. Yeah.
So you mentioned reporting on some of the stuff to your customers. Are there key metrics or KPIs that you deliver in your monthly report? Or is it more about we stopped this or found this?
Yeah. So that's another thing, right? Like everybody's got thoughts about what they want in that report. And what we don't want to be, and we've seen from other solutions, is every month you get a 127-page report. You look at it, you get scared, you have questions. Why is this connection coming from this scary country? You know, why didn't I hear about this thing? Is this bad? That's not the kind of reports that we want to deliver. So the reports have, you know, some of the metrics that you expect to see, right? Number of malicious cases, you know, blocked quarantine emails, users reporting messages, emails. What's the success rate? Are they reporting malicious emails? You know, what, you know, some stats around endpoint counts and log counts, all that kind of stuff that you'd expect to see that the service is working. The most meaningful metrics to me for us and our customers are we include our what we call notable threats or notable cases. And so these are the real stories. These are the real something happened in your environment and we have specific concerns. This could have been an incident. This is indicative of a threat that's interested in this type of thing. And we think that you should implement this control before it's too late. These are your pen test results and findings, right? And by marking and flagging those notable cases, not every malicious case is a notable threat, but getting those ones that have the real, again, recommendations, stories.
This looks like reconnaissance. Somebody's planning to maybe do something here.
The type of things that when you're doing your board meeting and you've got to talk about security, it's one thing to put up all those numbers and stats. It's another one to talk through, hey, we need to implement MFA on this thing because, you know, here's an example where this failed. Here's an example where that thing, this was a new employee, but this could have been someone, right? Like those stories are going to help you explain the impact. And so getting those notable threats, there are those cases that customers can use to understand how to prioritize their roadmaps and initiatives around, again, those notable threats. We're trying to keep everybody focused on the relevant threats, not just checkboxing compliance items or things like that, right? So that's what we use those notable threats for. So you got sort of stats around that. Everybody wants that to be zero. Really, you want that to be one or two, but nothing really bad happened, but it could have. right? That's what everybody wants. You want the good story, but no impact so that you can make a good recommendation. The other things that we show on our reports are our threat hunts, our proactive threat hunts, which is our way to our customers of sharing them sort of proactively. Hey, this thing that you're seeing in the news or this new technique or this new vulnerability, we're on top of it, right? Like we're evaluating our existing detections, we're building new detections, we're running retrospective threat hunts to see, you know, if this threat exists in your environment. Basically, we got it covered. Well, what that also becomes for our customers is, hey, here's everything that was happening in the world that was affecting us in the cyber land, and we were on top of it, and this is why we have that control, and this is why we're doing those things, and this is why security matters. Yeah, so those get highlighted again for some of that storytelling.
Yeah, because sadly, if security's working, you don't see it. So you've got to kind of show that in the background, there's stuff happening and there's a good reason that you're there doing your job.
Yeah.
So we talked a lot about how you've scaled the sort of day-to-day monitoring and sort of operational side of things. Has the approach to incident response had to change as the MSSP scaled? Like, you're still responding to active incidents. Have you made changes there, or has that remained relatively static?
So the funny thing about incident response, man, I wish I could remember who said this out loud on LinkedIn, but every time you see, not every time, but a lot of the time, when you see the awesome blog post coming from the MSSP about, you know, the incident that they worked, a lot of the times that winds up being a failure, the detection response side, because they're working a big incident. So we really pride ourselves on avoiding the big incidents, right? And again, an advantage in the MSSP side, though, is we get some control over when we put out the taking external IR shingle, right? We can control the flow of incidents that kind of come into the SOC. So we keep all our customers out of the really gnarly ones, and then we can kind of dip our toe into the
help people on the worst day of their lives kind of thing.
Which, yeah, put that jingle out, right? Which would, and keep the right balance, right? Bob, our CEO, you know, he comes from a firefighting background, and he, what he likes to say is, you know, every once in a while, you know, after doing a lot of not exciting firefighting work, you just got to work to structure fire, right? So we're fortunate in being able to, you know, as long as we keep doing our job on the SOC side, kind of pick and choose a little bit the incidents that we bring in, you know, in the tempo of all those. So the approach to IR, you know, for anybody familiar, you know, Eric Capuano and Whitney Champion through the recon side have that breaches be crazy, right? So that original, that like Velociraptor pipeline. Again, one of those, when I think back to the guard days, one of the things we were like, if only this existed. And then Eric and Whitney went and built a whole evidence processing pipeline, automating all that time sketch and parsing and Plazo. And man, when I first started and we were doing all that manually, that's a bummer. So now we're able to do it at scale through the existing endpoints and really also easily transition from that sort of deep dive forensics of a new environment to continuous monitoring and post incident monitoring and things like that. So
very cool. So we're getting close to the end here. If you had a piece of advice for somebody who was thinking about starting an MSSP or was early in the journey of building an MSSP, what advice would you give them based on your experience to save them pain down the road?
So don't underestimate the data engineering problem, right? The big data problem of security operations. And don't start with the collection of tools that you think you need, right? Instead, I would start with a really clear philosophy around how you want to do security operations. What does it look like for you to be finding threats, you know, 24/7? What does that look like? And then start building your requirements from there. And it's not just get a collection of tools and put them in front of people that you call analysts. You really should have a really good idea of what you're getting into and how you're going to run a SOC, not just how you're going to use some tools that you bought.
This is the last one I have for you. It's a variation on the one I ask of everybody that comes on the show. It can be as wide or as narrow as you want. Do you have any predictions for the future of the way MSSPs play their role in the cybersecurity industry?
Oh, that's a great question. So what's interesting to me, I want to see how AI, the really bullish AI ventures sort of pan out, where they're claiming to, you know, automate the analyst, automate security operations to the point potentially where what would be MSSP customers think that they don't need an MSSP, they just need this AI agent. To me, it seems a little bit silver bullet. I think maybe those tools are going to be useful for an MSSP to put next to a SOC and go side saddle, right? But yeah, I'm going to be interested in seeing how MSSPs are going to compete against more AI native services that may or may not be calling themselves MSSPs. And yeah, it's either going to be something that MSSPs need to adapt or evolve or get kicked out if that winds up working. But I'm really curious how that's going to pan out. We've got some really interesting use cases that we're using and we're building on the AI side that I'm really excited about. But again, what does it look like if Microsoft releases security agent, you know, analyst, and you just build it in your vendor license and that's your security analyst and you call that your MSSP? I don't know.
Yeah, I think we all snickered at AI for a long time because marketing kind of jumped the gun and plastering AI on everything for years and we never saw any results. But the pace of change now, I think a lot of people are really understanding that this is going to play a big role. I'm not sure what it's going to look like, but it's not going anywhere. And it's getting better at a pace that I've never seen the technology advance before.
Yeah, we say here is, and we've asked everybody, is what would your job look like if you had 4 interns, right? So you can trust the AI stuff about as far as you could trust your unsleeping, sleep-deprived, overeager, sometimes too eager intern. What would your role look like? And breaking those down, we have some really fun use cases that have made a difference. And yeah, that's
a great exercise. I'm going to actually take that away after this conversation and spend a minute thinking about what I would do with some interns. Awesome. Andrew, thank you so much for coming out. I know we ask a lot of the Recon folks as far as helping us over here at Lima Charlie. Really appreciate everything you do for us and look forward to chatting again in the future.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Okay, take care. And that concludes this episode of the Cybersecurity Defenders podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas for future topics, please send an email to defenders@limacharlie.io. You can access the intel we talk about on the show in real time and join the conversation on the Lima Charlie Community Slack channel at slack.limacharlie.io. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider sharing it with someone or leaving a rating or review. And don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening from. Thanks for listening in. We'll see you on the next episode.